Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, a major vaccine shift and a lot more AstraZeneca confusion.
In addition, an mRNA vaccine should now be offered as the second dose for individuals who received a first dose of AstraZeneca or Covishield vaccine.
Okay, another change. The National Advisory Council on Immunization suddenly does not recommend AstraZeneca for any second doses. What does this mean for those who've already had two shots of the AZ? Are they protected? What about being able to travel? CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdul Sharkawi will join us later to break down the implications of this. Glenn McGregor will be here to give you more facts on why they've made this shift. And also today, a new Supreme Court Justice, Mahmoud Jamal, is nominated to service on the highest court of the land. What challenges will he face? And should the Chief Justice currently, Chief Justice Richard Wagner, still be the acting Governor General? Check this out.
I accomplished that role as administrator of the government. Of course, it is a constitutional duty. It was my duty. And when I wear this hat of administrator, I don't wear the hat of the judge.
Today, we have a rare interview with the man you just saw. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Richard Wagner, is standing by. He'll talk about juggling those two hats he talked about. And what about the move for diversity on the top court and other issues? Chief Justice Wagner joins us in just a minute. Plus, cutting back pandemic aid. Why is the federal government cutting the Canada Recovery Benefit? Is it too soon to do that? Or are these benefits stopping some businesses from finding workers to fill empty spots? The Employment Minister, Carla Quattro, is also standing by. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. It's been close to 6 months since the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Richard Wagner, has been juggling two of the highest roles in the land. The Supreme Court Justice has been pulling double duty as the head of Canada's top court and serving as the acting Governor General. Well, now the Chief Justice might be seeing a new face. Well, he is going to be seeing a new face alongside him on the Supreme Court bench. The Prime Minister's office has just officially announced that Mahmoud Jamal will be the nominee to replace Justice Rosie Abella. She retired at the age of 75. That's the mandatory age of retirement. And he will now be the first person of color appointed to Canada's Supreme Court. What does Chief Justice Wagner make of this historic announcement? And also, how he's handled this last half year. It has been busy. It is an absolute honor to have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Richard Wagner, join us right now. Thank you, sir, for being here, Chief Justice. What a pleasure. There's so much to speak about with you, but today is also the day where Mahmoud Jamal is going to join you on the Supreme Court as the first person of color. Can you comment on his role? I mean, he's replacing Rosie Abella, who was the first Jewish woman to sit on the bench. Are these important things to consider?
Yeah, it was a very good day for the court, I must say. I had my first press conference this morning. It was my fourth press conference, as a matter of fact. And this afternoon, the Prime Minister announced the appointment of Justice Jamal, which is a great appointment. It's in line with the consultation that we had. You know, I met with the members of the selection committee. I met with the Justice Minister, consultation also with the Prime Minister. So he's well regarded. It's a great news for the court. It's a great news for the justice system. And we are very pleased to welcome Justice Jamal at the Supreme Court of Canada. I've been arguing for many years now that the court should reflect society. And that's why I think it's very important that diversity be reflected on the court.
Let's talk about that. You're right. This would be the first essentially non-white person ever, so the first person of color. It leaves the bench not gender balanced. It will now be six men and three women. But what do you say to those folks who say justice should be blind, that it shouldn't be necessarily made up? Those considerations may be secondary. How do you calibrate or balance that with the need for the court to, as you say, sir, reflect society?
Well, I think it's up to the Prime Minister to, decide on the appointments. But my point is that we should try, and the government should try, to get as much diversity as possible on the bench, if only to reflect society. The gender balance is one element. I think that the prime minister will have another chance next year to appoint another judges on the court, and that could be a woman. So the gender balance will be respected. So there are all kinds of criteria. I think it's a big step that has been taken today. I'm very happy with that, and I think we are on the right path for the future.
Supreme Court Justice, the government tabled their bill to modernize the Official Languages Act, as you know. One of the provisions is to enshrine bilingualism on the Supreme Court. There are some who are concerned that that may disqualify some parts of the country where bilingualism is less prevalent in the West, in some communities, Aboriginal communities. There has never been an Aboriginal Canadian on the bench. What do you make of that provision? Should it be open to non-English or perhaps non-French-speaking bilingual citizens?
I understand the concern, but I have two answers to that issue. First of all, I take the position of the citizens of this country. And every citizen, every Canadian citizen in this country has the right to present his or her case to the Supreme Court in one of the official languages. And when you take this position, which is quite fundamental in Canada, then you will expect the justices of the Supreme Court to be able to exchange, to speak, to talk, to understand, to learn, to read in both official languages. So that's the first step. That doesn't mean that other people cannot eventually file application to become a justice of the Supreme Court, even if that person does not speak both languages. Eventually, what we've done, what the judges, what the stakeholders have done for a number of years now is to invite, to promote persons who would like to sit on the bench, whether it be lower courts or the Supreme Court, to take lessons, to learn one of the two languages. So
right.
It has been done. It is done right now, and it will be done in the very near future. And I would expect, for instance, to have an Indigenous justice on the bench within the next few years.
Oh, that would be interesting. Okay. You have been doing something very unique. I think this is the longest or the second longest time Canada has gone without a governor general after Julie Payette stepped down. You have, of course, as our constitution requires, you step in to fulfill the duties of the governor general. And I'm sure it's made you very busy, Chief Justice. But there are concerns because you sign orders in council. You sign royal assent now. And I know it's part of the law, but there is concern that it puts you in an awkward position. Do you believe that you should recuse yourself from some legislation that you signed for royal assent that the court may then have to rule on or weigh in on that? Are there any circumstances by which you should say, no, that might give the perception that it's not totally objective?
Absolutely not. That's my short answer. Because, when I give royal assent, for instance, or sign decrees or documents, I wear my hat as administrator of the Government of Canada. And it's my duty. I have no choice. It is also a privilege for me to fill that gap between the time that we are waiting for an appointment of the Governor General. So I don't give opinion. I don't give any legal opinion, advice when I give royal assent. I simply accomplish my duty, my constitutional duty. And I see no reasons why I should recuse myself eventually should a legislation be challenged in court.
I know these are delicate issues, and of course, I want to desperately ask you about the notwithstanding clause, which has recently been used in Ontario. It's been used, I think, about 17 times in Quebec in history, but it was supposed to be rarely used. But there are critics who say that if the court is infringing on the jurisdiction of Parliament, that provinces are going to use the notwithstanding clause to assert their primacy of Parliament. I'm just intrigued to see how you respond to the accusation that the courts are becoming too powerful, that they're starting to to over-legislate, and that that's why we're seeing provinces flex back and assert the primacy of legislators by using the notwithstanding clause?
I'm sure you will understand that I will not comment on this issue. I will only tell you that the court, as usual, will render decisions based on the evidence and based on the arguments. And for the rest, it's up to other people to answer those type of questions that you just asked me.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, Justice Abella retired, and I spoke to her extensively on CTV's question period, but in a speech in 2018, she said this: a Supreme Court is the final adjudicator of which contested values in a society should triumph. And she specifically talked about which contested values. And of course, you know where that means. Does the Supreme Court determine values, as Justice Abella spoke about, or determine laws? Which is it?
I will not comment on my dear friend's interviews. I think it's up to her to give her opinion. I only can reiterate the fact that the court will render its decision based on evidence and arguments. You know, for all the other questions, I would like to be part of the debate, so that's why I would not comment.
I knew you wouldn't, but I have to give it a try, sir, as you know. What is the, you talked a lot about access to justice, and access to justice is a profound issue, as you know. I'm intrigued what you think the biggest challenge right now to the courts are in Canada right now.
Well, you know, you're right. Access to justice, we've been talking of access to justice for years and years now, and even before the pandemic started. And so what happened with the pandemic, it brought us to the 21st century in a way, in forcing the courts and other institutions to use technology to make sure that justice is rendered. And I think that the biggest challenge right now for the courts is would be to lower the backlog. I think that there's a risk of backlog at the trial level because of the pandemic. Although the most urgent matters were dealt with through technology, but that will be a challenge for the upcoming years.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some say, everyone's always said access to justice is always a big issue, but how do you actually fix it? You talk about the use of technology. I'm intrigued by that. But is it just the nature of our system? You've got appeals, you've got challenges. We always are trying to say access is better, but can you actually make the system more efficient, or do we really have to kind of reinvent the system a bit?
Well, both, I think. I think that what the pandemic, this terrible pandemic has brought, the only good side I could, if I can say, is to maybe look at new ways to do justice, to release justice. And at the same time, it becomes more efficient. Even before the pandemic, there were some problems for access to justice. It was too long, too many delays. It was too costly. Mm-hmm. And, we released a decision by the name of Jordan, which sent a big signal. And most stakeholders in the justice system realized that they had to do something. The governments, law societies, lawyers, and that's why steps were taken to improve with all kinds of remedies. There is no magic solution. There is no magic remedy. There are a full line of remedies that could be used, like pro bono work, like increasing legal aid, like all kinds of initiatives. And following the pandemic, those objectives mm-hmm. remained the same. But with the use of more technology now that we know that it can be helpful and useful.
Last question to you. I know you're still acting as the Governor General. We don't have another Governor General. There could be an election anytime soon, as you know, which could get tricky. Do you think we're going to get a Governor General by the summer, or do you think your busy schedule, Chief Justice, is going to continue?
Well, I take it one day at a time, sir. So today I signed many, many documents. Tomorrow is another day. And I'll wait until the Prime Minister makes the announcement about the new Governor General. For the time being, I'm continuing to do my work.
I would just say what a pleasure it is to have you on the program. I know it's a rare thing to be able to speak to the Supreme Court Chief Justice. It is a real honor to have you on the program. I really appreciate it, and I know our viewers do, sir. Thank you very, very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. That is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Richard Wagner, also, of course, acting as our Governor General. And that keeps him busy. But some fascinating insights there into the major challenges of our justice system. To some major vaccine news now. The National Advisory Council on Immunization suddenly does not recommend AstraZeneca for any second doses. Another flip-flop. For those people who have already had those two shots of AstraZeneca, what does it mean for them? Why the sudden shift? Let me bring in CTV's senior political reporter, Glenn McGregor, who's been following the bouncing needle here. And Glenn, what exactly has NACI said this time?
It is a bouncing needle. Every couple of months, we're getting a new story about AstraZeneca. First, it was great, take it. Then it was don't take it. And then it was wait. So now the new recommendation is that it should not be used for either a first dose or a second dose. That's because of a couple of reasons. First of all, there's still these ongoing concerns about the blood clotting issue that's cropped up in a rare number of cases, but it is a serious concern. Secondly, they are saying that new science emerging that shows mixing the AstraZeneca with another mRNA vaccine is actually giving you better results than having just two doses of AstraZeneca alone. So they're now saying those small number of people, well, not small number, 2 million people about in Canada who have had the AstraZeneca, if they are waiting for their second shot, they should not get a second shot of AstraZeneca. Some people would have had the choice up until very recently. The pharmacies and public health agencies were offering people to choose which one. They're saying, no, don't take the AstraZeneca, the second shot. Take an mRNA shot.
Right. Although, Glenn, you and I both know, we know people, you and I personally, who took the second AstraZeneca this past week, some of them as late as today. Now they're confused. And I know we're going to bring on Dr. Sharkawi later. But, man, there's a lot of confusion there. And then there's this travel issue. A lot of people are reading that Bruce Springsteen on Broadway, a show that I would love to see. They will not accept people with an AstraZeneca dose because it's not approved in the U.S. So if you're on the AstraZeneca, like I took the first AstraZeneca shot, I guess we're born to canoe, but we're not born to run. What does all this mean?
If you were to go to Broadway and try and get into the boss's show, you would be dancing in the dark outside the theater. You're not going to get in. And you're also not going to get in to see Jimmy Fallon or Saturday Night Live for their live audience studio tapings. They've also followed the same policy. This advice seems to be coming from the state of New York's health department. They're saying only FDA-approved vaccines can be used. And of course, that's Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. But it really does show you the confusion and how complicated this issue is of resolving international vaccine passports. We've heard a lot of talk about this, some sort of standardization, a way of people from different countries to show that they've had full vaccination. But if the Americans aren't going to accept AstraZeneca, well, what good is it for the people who have had one shot of AstraZeneca in Canada and maybe a second shot, or possibly one of the Pfizer or Moderna shots, or the vast number of people in the UK and also in Europe and South America as well, who have had AstraZeneca? They're not going to see Springsteen either. What does that mean for traveling around the United States in general, other events as well, not just the couple of rock concerts? So, it's a concern. This was talked about at the G7 last weekend and tried to get some of the leaders on the same page on vaccination passports. The Americans are not interested. The Europeans, though, they're forging ahead with something they call a digital COVID certificate. A lot of countries are taking it up, shows proof of immunity. So not just the fact that you have been double vaccinated, but also if you have been diagnosed with COVID and have recovered, you'd also be able to get in those things because they feel you have a natural immunity, Evan.
Yeah. So I guess unless you're born in the USA, you're on the 10th Avenue freeze out and you're stuck in the land of hopes and dreams. You and I could do Bruce Springsteen puns all night about this, but that kind of sucks. All right, Glenn McGregor, I appreciate that. And Glenn and I will probably call each other later and we'll just riff on Springsteen stuff
on
because we're on the AstraZeneca train. Riffing on the boss. All right, thanks, Glenn. Coming up, an $800 cut to a key COVID-19 benefit is coming next month. And the NDP says that money is a massive loss to Canadians trying to make rent or feed their families. Why cut the benefit when Canada's not out of the COVID-19 woods? We'll talk to Employment Minister Carla Quattro next. Stay with us. One party fighting against the planned reduction to a key COVID-19 benefit, federal government, remember, is set to trim the Canada Recovery Benefit, the CRB, by $800, about 40%, in July. Benefit recipients currently get $2,000 a month, but that will be reduced to $1,200 over a series of steps. The NDP is arguing against the reduction, saying $800 is the difference for many Canadians between making rent on time or getting groceries in their fridges. Will the cut go ahead as planned? Will the federal government possibly revisit it? Why? Because of so many job losses in the last few months. Let's find out. Joining me now is the Employment Minister, Carla Quattro. Minister, good to have you back on the program. The Canada Recovery Benefit, the CRB, almost 2 million Canadians have relied on it. It's now going to be cut by 40%, down by $800 in July, which is a substantial reduction. You know the NDP says keep it. It's way too soon to do it. What's the rationale for cutting it so dramatically by July?
Yeah, good question, Evan. I think right now the CRB is set at $500 a week for 38 weeks. And it's really important that we know that starting next week, about 450,000 people could begin to exhaust those first 38 weeks, which is why we're so focused on getting the Budget Implementation Act through C-30 to make sure that there's no disruption of benefits for those individuals. What the budget proposes is another 12 weeks, the first four at $500, and the last eight at $300. Now, that means that everybody can guaranteed get 42 weeks at $500. So if you haven't exhausted your first 42 weeks in July, say, you get $500 a week. It doesn't stop paying the $500 a week until you hit the threshold of 42. The rationale for that is seeing the transition in our recovery measures to encouraging employment, encouraging people to get back to work if they can, job creation. So, you know, enhancing the wage subsidy, creating the new Canada hiring program, creating 500,000 training and employment opportunities through the budget. So really pivoting to a focus on supporting businesses hire, supporting workers to get back to work and trained. And we think that this is the time to do that. But what I'll say is in the legislation, there is flexibility for us to extend the CRB through to November if that's required.
Oh, so you could extend it because, look, you know, the NDP's point is it's a pretty rough economy right now. Stats Can, you know, has pointed out 68,000 jobs lost in May because of the new lockdowns. Yep. Second consecutive month, 207,000 job losses in April. Unemployment rate in May, 8.2%, right? In April, 8.1%. Yep. So these are pretty bad numbers. Given those numbers, a delayed recovery, you might call it, is it really the time to say to those people, hey, it's tough to find a job. We're actually losing jobs. We're not gaining jobs. We're still going to cut it.
Well, we think right now this is the most prudent course of action. So again, as I said, we know from past openings that as soon as businesses are allowed to open, they rehire. And some want to retrain. So by creating kind of the new hiring program, which incentivizes people to hire people back, give people that you already have on staff more hours, we really want people to pivot to the wage subsidy, to the hiring program. But, you know, with extending the CRB, still have that cushion if you're not in that lucky position, I guess I'd say.
Okay, just a last question on the CRB. You said you wanted to incentivize people to get back to work. You know, there's a lot of small businesses who have said straight up that we can't find employers, right? So you've got all sorts of other, you know, the Canadian Federation of Independent Business has said, look, there's a lot of small business operators who can't find workers. They'd rather take the COVID-related benefits. StatsCan said there's something like 632,000 vacant jobs nationally in the last little while, especially in the service sector where they just can't find workers. So are you saying to us that the CERB benefits are actually preventing people from taking work and making it hard for employers to find workers?
No, that I'm saying quite the opposite. What we've seen through the labor market data is when jobs become available, people fill them. And if it's not the person that you had on staff before the closure, you can find somebody else. Like the stats show that even when more money was on the table, for, say last spring for CERB, people took the jobs. People want to work. I think it's this, it's a false narrative that, that other parties are perpetuating that, that Canadians don't want to work. Listen,
no, but
I understand.
To be fair, I know there's a lot of politics. The hospitality sector apparently has the highest vacancy rate it's ever had. Something like 7.5% of those jobs unfulfilled, right? The construction sector, almost 6% vacancy rate. That's not politics. Those are facts.
No, you're right. And that's why, you know, the idea of us supporting workers who can't work, supporting, you know, shoring up the jobs we have, filling the ones that are vacant, you know, whether it's training, you know, we're working on a sectoral project with the construction industry to train people and get them into these jobs. It's really important that we take a bunch of different approaches to this and meet Canadians where they are and meet businesses where they are. I'm super sensitive, and I hear it in my writing about businesses that can't find people. And so we really have to redouble our efforts and let people know about the jobs that are out there because, again, like I say, the data shows that people will fill them.
But I'm just trying to figure out. So you got one side saying get rid of the CRB because we can't find workers. We just can't, and we can't fill the vacancies. The other side are saying there's too much unemployment. You're punishing people who need to pay rent and get groceries. So there's some fine line. So what is the line you're going to walk?
That fine line we're walking, right? So we've been following the economy very closely, following job creation and job numbers. As you said, they went down the last couple of months, but we've also seen them, you know, bounce right back as soon as they're opening. So I'm going to paying real attention to the June numbers to see if we're heading back in the same direction. You know, it is hopeful, Evan, that we've recovered about 84% of the jobs that were lost during COVID, but that other 16% of jobs, people need support, and whether it's through more flexible EI or the CRB, we need to be there for them, and we need to be there for them at the beginning of next week.
Okay, but as you said earlier, there is a chance that you could maybe change that, and depending on what the job numbers look like. You just mentioned EI, so I want to quickly move over to that other workplace issue. The Standing Committee on Human Resources had a report on the EI system and says, look, the EI system is slow to respond to disruptions like the pandemic. Does the system need to be updated? Does it need to be expanded to include gig workers, people who are self-employed? Is that on the table?
Absolutely on the table, and that's why we're committed to modernizing EI. If one thing that the pandemic has showed of all the systems in the government of Canada, EI simply hasn't kept up with the way Canadians work, whether it's gig workers or self-employed or people who are working part-time paying into EI but never quite getting enough hours to actually draw from EI if they've been laid off. Absolutely, and that's what we're doing. I mean, we started by extending the flexibilities we put in place temporarily for another year, and now we're just talking with stakeholders on the employer side and the labor side with experts on what does a new EI system look like to you, a modern EI system that captures the way Canadians actually work today. And we've got about a year a year and 3 or 4 months to figure that out.
Yeah, or till the next election. We'll find that out, which could be sooner than that. Mr. Qualtrough, got to leave it there. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Nice speaking with you, Evan. Be safe.
Yeah, you too. Okay, stay with us. We got a really important and powerful, and I think a message that is disturbing but needs to be heard from someone who is leaving the House of Commons. Watch this.
I'm reminded every step of the way I don't belong here. I have never felt safe.
NDP MP Mumalak Kakak told her fellow MPs and Canada she doesn't belong on Parliament Hill. She's a 27-year-old MP. What needs to happen? She will join us next to find out and tell us her experience and what needs to change right now.
I I'm looking forward to a time where people like me could belong here, a time we can be here. I hope another young or Inuk or woman or all three will follow in my footsteps and continue pushing this institution to support Indigenous peoples in Canada.
Her final message to the House of Commons was powerful, unsettling, about her experience in Parliament. 27-year-old Mumalak Kakak told the House of Commons in her final speech there she would give herself pep talks in the parliamentary elevator, reminding herself that she did belong in the West Bloc. She's not seeking re-election when Canadians head to the polls, whenever that is. Her words in this week's farewell speech serve as a powerful reminder that it isn't just about electing people who represent diverse voices. It's about ensuring that they want to stay. How can that change? Let's find out. NDP MP Mumalak Kakak joins us now. Great to have you back on the program. It was an incredibly powerful speech that you gave. I want to get to the crux of it. Why did you feel that you don't belong? Why did you feel, when, as you've said, that I walked into the building, the Parliament buildings, on fire?
I think there's a number of things that make Indigenous people in general within Canada feel that we're out of place, that we don't belong. It's not a sole isolated incident just on the Hill. I've had incidents throughout my life in similarity to this. In this experience, it's troubling because these are the individuals I'm supposed to turn to as a member of Parliament to feel safe. They're supposed to be there for the protection of members of Parliament and those of the public, of course, but primarily so that we are there and ensuring we can do our job. So I didn't even fully kind of wrap my head around it, because it's similar to what I've been experiencing my whole life. At some point you feel like you should just ask the store clerk if they want to follow you around the store. You ask, what is this society built for me? And it's not. So when I came into this position, I was fully expecting some discrimination, some racism. I'm walking into a place where people are willingly not providing basic human rights, where it's clearly needed. I'm walking into a place where there are clearly racist ideations and ideologies. I'm walking into a place that not only upholds these racist policies and procedures, but builds them and fuels them. And there are so many examples that we can turn to in that. And I didn't realize, I guess, to an extent, the fact that I think so many non-Indigenous, so many white people are a surprise. This isn't a surprise for non-white individuals. So the only people that are shocked are white people.
Yeah, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I'm onboarding what you're saying. I thought some things, and I'll be candid with you. Yeah, it is maybe our own blindness that when you talked about being profiled by security in Parliament as a member of Parliament, when you talked about I want to make sure my hands are visible. Yeah, I plead. You know, maybe I shouldn't have been ignorant about that. I didn't think that in the very house that is the heart of our democracy. You felt that threatened.
But Evan is a very place that also denies rights for people. You know, I made that speech on Tuesday, and just earlier today, there was an opportunity on the PROC committee to have Indigenous languages on the ballot, and they wouldn't even have that discussion. You could see clearly so many of the members on the PROC committee today, shamefully, they wouldn't even. So the way that it works in the House of Commons is a committee will make amendments, and then those amendments are presented to the House of Commons. So I was presenting an amendment to Bill C-19 that would ensure we see Indigenous language on ballots so that we ensure Indigenous peoples are being able to vote in the way that they want to, in the way that they're able, and that they can be a part of this democracy. What did we see? We saw all of them. They wouldn't even talk about the amendment. They voted to not even talk about it, and very shamefully so. So we see very clearly all the time these examples.
So, but that's the procedures in House Affairs Committee that you said, and I just want our viewers to understand that. Okay, I don't ever want to make it incumbent on you, like, okay, you've got to fight for the change, because, of course, that's the whole issue. But you're a member of parliament. You get into our elected democracy, which is what everybody wants. Everyone talks about diversity, the need for new voices, the need for younger voices, the need for voices to represent every single community, and the need to make change. Now you've got it. Was it hard to decide not to run for re-election?
Hold on. How do we have it, though? Where is the change? The changes that we're seeing, reality being spoken, but where are we seeing actual change? We're not. We're not seeing.
No.
We saw 215 children and counting being dug up. There's no change. What change is there? There's an argument on whether or not that's considered a mass grave. There's, you know, debates being happened instead of discussing, rightfully moving towards justice and providing basic human rights. Like, we're getting into arguments about things that you would never see for any other group within Canada.
No, and I'm not suggesting the story. I just want to be clear. I'm certainly not suggesting there is the change. I'm saying that because now you've got, you're a member of parliament, we know it's a long fight. We know the long arc of history bends towards justice, but it bends over the fight of people who are dying and fighting. And I appreciate this, the pain of that. I guess my question is, was it difficult for you to decide not to run again and continue the fight to make the urgent changes that you're talking about, as opposed to saying, you know what, it's here, I'm going to put down the baton for a while and not run again? I'm just intrigued how you tried to calibrate that decision.
So there were a number of things that came into that. I think the most important thing to talk about first is that I did not intend on becoming a member of parliament until very late of August 2019. And I had no intention of ever getting into politics. I was asked by the Nunavut Electoral District Association if I'd be interested. And it was a few days before I even said, okay, here's a great opportunity in front of me. So I never had an intention to become a member of parliament until later. And to me, it was the best opportunity to help as many people as I can, show impossible is possible, and to try and fuel some anger and some frustration in this injustice. And people are living with these conditions every single day. Why aren't we all mad about it? Why aren't we all frustrated that there isn't the beautiful, glorious Canada that we think there is? I have been the voice here. I have been talking about reality. We know there is no reason to not take action now. And yet we still see the federal institution do that. I think Canada and Canadians outside of that are shifting and having a better understanding of why we're in this situation, what horrible history has led us here, and being more open-minded. Like, 10 years ago, who would have thought someone like me and someone like you would be having this conversation here like this? Things are moving, things are changing with the help of our allies, with the availability of basic human rights. There are things in that way. I guess what I'm frustrated with, and I don't see changes where the turmoil and the violence stems from, which is the federal institution.
Well, I'll tell you this. I know you're not running again. I hope this is not our last conversation. And I'll just tell you right here, you have an open invitation when you're no longer a member of parliament, whenever this next election is. Please join as a regular guest on this program. You know, we're always looking for important voices. Yours has always been one, and I hope it continues to be. So consider this an open invitation, and your words are resonating, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll be taking you up on that. Thanks a lot for this space, Evan.
Yeah, anytime. You know it. Anytime. Okay, that is Mumlet Kakak, and that is an open invitation. Anytime she wants to come back, you know we have regular commentators on, and she is more than welcome. All right, coming up, more confusion about AstraZeneca, more confusion about what you should be taking after the National Advisory Committee on Immunization suddenly says, don't take AZ as the second dose. Dr. Sharkawi weighs in to try to clear it all up. Stay with us.
An mRNA vaccine should now be offered as the second dose for individuals who received a first dose of AstraZeneca or Covishield vaccine. This change is based on emerging evidence indicating a potentially better immune response from this mixed vaccine schedule and to mitigate the potential risk of VIT associated with viral vector vaccines.
Okay, well, I didn't know that Shakespeare actually created AstraZeneca and it was made by Hamlet to take it or not to take it, to get it or not to get it. A lot of mixed messaging and more mixed messaging from the National Advisory Committee on Immunization. Now they're saying if you got the first dose of AstraZeneca, don't take a second dose. Take an mRNA, take a Pfizer or take a Moderna. Don't take another AZ. And for lots of people who said, wait, I was just told to take the AZ. I took the AZ because I wasn't sure about mixing and matching. But now they say, no, we've reviewed emerging evidence suggesting there'll be a stronger immune response when you got a first AstraZeneca dose followed by a second mRNA dose, and there's concerns about health, and then you just think to yourself, what the heck is going on? And that's when you bring in the press gallery. Joyce Napier, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for CTV National News, and Stephanie Levitz, the Parliamentary Hill reporter with the Toronto Star, and CTV News infectious disease specialist, Dr. Abdushar Kawi. And great news, I know rates are going down, and some hospitals like Toronto General had no new cases of COVID, which is great. Okay, Dr. Sharkawi, what's the deal here? There's a lot of people, literally there's someone in our office that just got the second dose of AstraZeneca. They were practically banging their head on the table here. What do you make of this?
Well, I think we have to separate the baggage with respect to communication and bad PR from AstraZeneca and lack of transparency to the reality of emerging evidence, cumulative data that we're seeing. And look, I've been very outspoken with respect to what I didn't think was ideal messaging from NACI earlier on, but I have to give credit where credit is due. At this point, I think this is a thoughtful and very well articulated recommendation. We're no longer dealing with, you know, bad versus good. At this point, we're dealing with good versus even better. And what NACI is saying is that the evidence, not just from Germany, but from the UK and from the Spanish study from before, is suggesting that not only is there now zero risk of this VIT or clot syndrome if you're using an mRNA platform, but we're actually seeing a better antibody response. So that means if you have the opportunity to get an mRNA vaccine, regardless of whether you got one before or you got AstraZeneca, you should go ahead and try and pursue that. It does not mean that if you get an AstraZeneca vaccine for both doses, you're in bad shape. You're in very good shape, but you have a better opportunity to minimize any risk and to further your benefit. So no one should feel badly about being on the AstraZeneca platform, but if you have the chance, embrace it. I don't think there's anything wrong with this decision at all.
Okay, Joyce has a confused face, and then I'll go to Steph. Joyce, go ahead.
I try not to look confused, but it is confusing, and that's why people have confused faces. That person that was banging her head against the table said, you know, now I feel like a second-class citizen. Look, the messaging was terrible. Look, we're not scientists, but the messaging was god-awful, and people are confused, and we're getting phone calls, and we're just journalists. We are getting phone calls from people asking us, you know, what they should do. So that just shows if you're asking a journalist which vaccine you need to take, that means that there's a lot of confusion out there. Not that we're naturally confused people, but look, there's NACI, there's Health Canada, there's the provinces, there are, you know, health districts. There are 34 of them in Ontario. That's called cacophony, and that is what's happening. So yes, if you've had a first AstraZeneca shot, now you should have another kind of shot, an mRNA. What if you had two AstraZenecas? Those are the calls that we're getting as well. Like, you know, people, messaging is important. And I think that they have managed with all these various advisory boards and various levels, have managed to confuse even those that weren't confused at first. And okay, it's a moving target, but can you be more coherent? That would be really good. Coherence would be fantastic right now.
Except, I mean, the problem has to be, like, if I can jump in, science is not necessarily always coherent. And if there's been a challenge all of Canada has faced, and indeed the world, throughout the pandemic is that the science is constantly evolving. And I, you know, it was a few months back, I don't remember what the context was necessarily, but Dr. Tam was talking about, you know, now we have real world examples of how the vaccines are working. We have better data. We have more data. And that data is going to change. The challenge becomes when the messaging around the data is not communicated clearly and people are led to expect that everything is zero sum, that every decision is the final decision, but it isn't. It won't be because the science will continue to evolve. For example, I'm sure we're all going to need boosters in another 6, 8, 10, 12 months. What's going to happen then? And if one hopes that perhaps the folks at NACI, the folks at Health Canada, are looking at the communications landscape, recognizing their errors, and trying to figure out a way to keep the messaging consistent and clear, because without it, we run into the wall of vaccine hesitancy. And that's a humongous problem for keeping the cases coming down, keeping the cases out of the hospitals like we've seen in Toronto and elsewhere. That's super important.
Okay. I know I got about 20 seconds. Just quickly, Steph Levitz, I know the U.S. is saying if you take the AstraZeneca, you can't get into the Bruce Springsteen show or the Jimmy Fallon. I don't want to do more Bruce Springsteen puns, although I'd love to do it. Does the world have to get their act together? And like the U.S. say, if you got the AZ, you're still safe. Like, what do you make of that?
There has to be some coherence there. I mean, that's where the WHO can play a role. That's where some of the other international health bodies can play a role. Look at the science, look at the data, look at the effectiveness. And hopefully come to some kind of standard where they will accept it.
Yeah, I got Joyce, 10 seconds on that. You want to weigh in?
I think eventually the Americans will accept AstraZeneca. Look, it is a legitimate vaccine. A lot of people in Europe have had it. And if they want any British tourists, they'll have to change their mind.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well... I'd like to go there as well. Joyce, Steph, and Dr. Sharkawi. Dr. Sharkawi, always a pleasure to have you on the program. A little short today on the press gallery because we had the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada on a long interview, which was a real honor to have. Joyce is going to be in the chair on CTV Question Break. To my wife, happy 20-year anniversary. I'm going to go home and celebrate 20 years of marriage. And probably for her, it feels like 40. I love you. See you tomorrow. Thanks for watching. Hug your loved ones.